This is the Conference Committee on Senate Bill 323, De-Engrossed. We are meeting on June 18, 1987 at 1 p.m. in Hearing Room 350.
Bring us up to date on some changes he's made in our green book, which he thinks will help us make the comparison. So I'll let Eric go ahead and explain that.
I left the material that was in there yesterday in case you had written on it so that it would be there, but I also started over. So there is a tab in your book labeled 61887. And the first thing that's in there is Catherine's SMA for the de-engrossed version. After that, you will find a series of pages which open to face each other so that you have the punitive damages sections that are in conflict on pages 2 and 3. I won't say in conflict, but differ. Now, as a general rule, what you'll find is that the C-engrossed version appears first, but the order is of the de-engrossed sections, so that it proceeds through in order from the de-engrossed from section one of the de-engrossed to the end. On those areas where they were alike, I simply noted that rather than reprinting both pages. Sometimes, such as on page 5, you'll see that sections from each of the versions is on the same page. That's to try and cut down a few less trees with a note as to what it does. Catherine is working on a more extended commentary, and that will be in your books tomorrow. The other thing to note is that the language that's different is either underlined or there's a note out in the margin. If you look at pages 6 and 7 on the cap, the language that's underlined is different between the two versions, and there is also a marginal note so that 2B on page 7, for example, is not in the C version, and sub 4, the note on both of them is that it's the opposite of what's in the other version. The last thing that's in your book is a comparison chart that Catherine did, printed in a horizontal format, which compares the original 323, the C-engrossed version, and the D-engrossed version. And that's back at the back. At this point, we are through sections about 96 or 97. There's plenty in here to keep us busy for the next couple of days. And when we meet tomorrow, we will have finished putting the material in the book.
Council, let me go back to pages 2 and 3 here and mention first on the de-engrossed side there. You have in
I'm
your
sorry.
Margin, that should be a C.
Should be it? A C, yes, not in C. Thank you.
In the right-hand margin on page 3, not in D, should be not in C.
At the top.
Something that I overlooked yesterday, I'm looking at the C-engrossed page 2
right
and section 4. I'm wondering if the House members could tell me whether that particular procedure was not considered or whether it was considered and rejected in the House. That was probably one of the very few completely non-controversial issues that we had from the beginning of the project until the time we sent the bill out. Can somebody recall whether that was actually discussed, or I'm wondering whether it was oversight?
I'll have to reflect about my notes. I don't even recall discussion of it, to tell you the truth.
Okay. It might not have been discussed at all. Well, then let's go on. And I think
we had done punitive damages, we had done the cap, we had done joint and several liability, We had done contingent fee agreements, so at page 11, we will be at collateral sources.
Okay, and, of course, yes, that's something we didn't have at all in the Senate version, so there we are. And is that, that's the complete section on collateral sources?
That's correct.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
It would be helpful for, to have Eric or somebody track down the original collateral sources piece that was in the, whatever bills, whenever, what was it, the task force bill, or maybe it was the original 323 bill, to have that at hand, to kind of take a look at it and see what that is as an option, too.
Well, who wants to comment on this?
On the, you want to comment on how we reached the agreement on collateral source?
Yeah, can you just kind of give me at least the thinking of your committee and why this should be in there.
This was an extremely controversial topic, not so much in subcommittee or committee, but because, the Senate, I don't believe it was addressed in the bill that came over, so that a case had to be made that it needed to be addressed at all, so that was difficult to do. There were several members of the committee who, upon reflection, there are so many different increments involved in collateral source. If an individual through a bargaining unit gives up a raise 15 years ago because he gets a policy that covers a disability policy, that covers disability, and for 15 years he has given that raise up, how does the court go in and say that we're going to pay you the face value for that policy? There was a lot of discussion about pensions, and essentially what we arrived at was that we put in a section that says the judge may take a look at this issue. There was then a lot of discussion once it came out of subcommittee with the word may in the section.
Line 40.
The third word from the end of the sentence. That this section really doesn't do anything. There was a great deal of argument over that, and the word shall was proposed instead of may, and that was we didn't go along with that. A number of committee members, upon reflection once again and a lot of discussion, suggested that the judge should have the discretion to do this, but that we weren't ready to order the judge to do it in every case. And we felt that the section we passed gives the judge the discretion to do that, but doesn't order the judge to do it in every case. And that's...
The point of defining what we meant by collateral source, I think, is important, too. Especially the exclusion parts, the Social Security, retirement, pension. There was considerable debate on how much should be exempted, what should be exempted, and setting up a framework with discretion to the judge after the verdict has been given. Quite a bit of support for that. In fact, a lot of support for the shall language, but that was a heavily debated point.
Well, also on the exemptions, there were other motions. From my perspective, weakening the exemptions, for instance, the word on federal Social Security benefits, it was suggested that the word retirement be placed in there. And as committee members are aware, there are orphans benefits along with other Social Security programs that people do receive compensation from Social Security. It was felt by the committee, and there was a lot of discussion on this, that those programs should be exempt from consideration, all the programs, not just the federal Social Security retirement program.
Do you, a couple of questions I've got. On line 38, you've got property damage in there, too. Now, what about the situation where we have a subrogation where your own, let's take a simple case, your own company has paid you off under the collision provisions of your policy, and then your company goes ahead against the party at fault to try and recover in a subrogation proceeding. proceeding here. Does this, does the fact that, how does it come out that here's the plaintiff now, who's the nominal party, really is the insurance company that's in court suing the tortfeasor, does the fact that the nominal plaintiff's insurance company is paid off in a collision loss, would that be the type of collateral source? It seems to me it would be, and is that what you really want to happen?
Well, the way I read it, once a verdict or settlement is reached, the judge may consider that.
The issue, however, is many of these benefits are subrogated already.
Right.
That's why those parties that felt the shall language should be in there put a strong case that everything should be compared and therefore taken out of any verdict award. There were cases, I know our chairman and perhaps yourself, Senator, where workers' comp actions and liens and the whole process with regard, and we didn't want to open up that Pandora's box and penalize somebody adversely, so that's why the May language and trying to define it as closely as we could. From a policy standpoint, it was sound that in some cases there may be a good justification for the judge taking action, and probably would be. In others, we felt that it should be the latitude. Those that supported the shall language frankly came in and said the judge will never do it because we didn't make them do it. I don't happen to agree with that.
One of the, not to speak for Representative Burton, but I think both he and I felt during the course of the conversation that if you have taken upon yourself to plan for your future, and you purchased a disability policy or anything else to cover your family or your person in the case of an accident occurring, the case was made before the subcommittees, I'm sure it was made before the Senate committee, that there shouldn't be a windfall if you were involved in an accident. And Representative Burton and I vehemently disagreed. I know perhaps Representative Phillips would disagree with that, but if you have taken it upon yourself to plan for your future, and you've done that outside of any incident or occurrence impacting your life or a liability situation exists, and then have the court say, well, we're going to pay you what you put into the policy, but because you received $50,000 from a disability policy that you forced your family budget to have that money taken out of the family budget for 15 years, we're going to subtract the $50,000 you get from that disability policy from your actual settlement. Both of us, in putting the package together, felt that that wasn't right, or we didn't agree with it. So,
in looking at, let's take health insurance benefits there, as that phrase is used on line 4, I would assume from language on lines 39 and 40 that if health insurance benefits had been received and there was no obligation to repay those would fall under the collateral source doctrine anyway, right?
Right.
Okay, now the last question that I've got is procedural. That is, in subsection 2, the costs... what is it that you present to the court after the verdict has come in? And what procedure do you go through to rebut this, whatever it is that you present? Is it done by affidavit? How do you envision that happening?
Well, in fact, that's exactly... I would suspect in an actual case, the defendant would by affidavit say these are collateral sources. The plaintiff's counsel would make arguments whether they are or they aren't, and then the judge would make a determination.
All right, you wouldn't contemplate, for example, that there would be a kind of a mini hearing where the parties would be examined on the witness stand, or there would be discovery procedures used. It would just be done by affidavit?
It was pretty clear that this is only to be done by affidavit, and both parties would have their chance to rebut, and then the trier of fact would make a determination. And it was not a supplemental hearings process in the true sense.
Any other questions by committee members on this part of it?
Just can I ask counsel to refresh my memory in terms of what the task force recommended in this area?
Perhaps
I think there was Senator Coleman.
Well, I asked for the information, I didn't expect that we'd have it momentarily, but I do need to have it, I've asked to have it put on the table along with.
I don't recall precisely, except that it was somewhat like this, I think.
Yeah.
I think it was a bit different somehow still, and I would need to look at it.
All right, we'll get that information. And by the way, in passing, before I forget it, Catherine went ahead and checked out our, remember yesterday we were discussing whether this punitive damages, the language, the vicarious liability of employers for the punitive, for the malicious conduct of the employees that was in the bill, whether that was different from case law or whether this really codified. You remember that discussion? And I think Catherine went ahead and dug into that a little bit. Did you want to
It would reverse current case law. And under current case law, the restatement of torts was rejected and was not applicable Oregon law. The draft is the restatement of torts, so in effect it would change current case law. And I went back and listened to the tape of Professor Vetri that was referenced, and his conversation was actually when he talked about vicarious liability was when he was talking to and recommending that punitive damages be insurable and that we remove the section of the bill that made punitive damages non-insurable.
Well, Mr. Chair,
yes,
the case was Stroud versus Denny's Restaurant. It's an Oregon Supreme Court case. Irrespective of, it's good public policy to have it in the bill, and the debate was there, and I don't know the purpose of bringing it up. Appreciate the information, but it's good policy.
Either I raised the question or someone else did, whether this was a codification of the existing case law or whether it was new. Kind of an academic, it's academic in a way.
Yeah.
We don't have to follow what the current law is by any means. But, yes, refresh my memory on that. Was that restaurant case that you just mentioned?
Yeah. Okay. 1975, I believe. The council did a memo on that in our debate discussion. And it was Amendment 74, if that helps you do follow it up.
Yeah, okay. No, I went back and checked the case law today.
All right. Okay, well then we'll move along. Didn't we discuss...
We discussed injury during death of felony.
That's what I thought we did. All right, let's go. Let's move on to page 13. Now... of course, they're like the way you've handled punitive damages in your house bill, the way you've handled the non-meritorious lawsuits or malicious prosecution is also quite different from the way we handle it.
That's correct.
Who wants to talk about that?
Well, the significant difference, as I see it, is the ability to file an action in the same action or counterclaim. That was debated, I believe, in front of your committee in the form of a minority report. Senator Brenneman might speak to that. The issue was brought up, feeling that this, in fact, would require and bring about the ability to address frivolous actions immediately rather than waiting for them to run their full course, exhaust both parties physically, emotionally, and financially, and therefore they would not be able to seek redress or wouldn't accept that ability. So the ability to bring about action as it's written in the de-engrossed would facilitate immediate and prompt action on frivolous actions.
How do you know it's frivolous until you've got a result, though?
Well, that, of course, is one of the center points of the debate, Senator.
Kind of curious to me. I'm quite confident that if we put this in the statutes, that Oregon would be the only state that allowed that kind of a procedure. And my guess is that the reason that it doesn't exist anywhere else is because it would be a practicable, possible situation, I think. So.
Well, that's what they said about many of the laws that Oregon was first on, too, And the fact is, just because you're first doesn't mean it's wrong. We provide the option to make the claim. The determination, obviously, there's frivolous actions both by the plaintiffs and by the defendant, so both parties could be held accountable.
Would this I assume would also permit the the plaintiff then to raise in what might be called the reply, I suppose, the fact that the defendant's answer was frivolous. Would that be possible?
Oh, I'm sure it would be possible, and I'm sure a plaintiff's attorney would explore that. In addition, the issue was raised about if you file an action in this process, you would disqualify the plaintiff's attorney perhaps from pursuing the main case, and thus we added the language on line 29 through the end, which prevented the disqualification of counsel in this type of an action, so that they would be able to continue representing them.
Even if there might be some ethical problem there.
My question is, if there was a case or an alleged need for disqualifying, does that mean you had to separate them out? I guess that's not clear, because if you have a conflict of interest, you have a conflict of interest whether you're disqualified or not disqualified. It seems to me that the issue is, if there's any question of that, you have to not allow it. You have to separate the issue somehow.
Seems like it.
Rather than allow it to, and then it's not enough to say it's okay, you can't be disqualified, but you can continue on in some arena of possible prejudice. I guess that's it.
Sure.
Yes, John.
Wouldn't this be similar in procedure to a summary judgment?
Unless I'm...
Were you filed in the case, though? Aren't they, or during the case, summary judgments quite often?
Summary judgments, of course, come up before there's any presentation of the evidence. That's a pre-trial procedure. I guess the thing that concerns me is you really wouldn't know, I suppose, until the case is concluded, whether you've got a non-meritorious case. And the critical number one element of a malicious prosecution action is success in the case that you're defending to start with. I mean, you always have to allege and prove that you were successful in defending the first action before you can bring the second action for malicious prosecution. I don't know at what point in time. Well, the jury, I guess, is going to decide when it gets the case, well, was the plaintiff wrong to bring the case to start with, or?
I think there's no question that if you were to exercise this option as a defense counsel or plaintiff's counsel on frivolous defense, you would have to make that judgment. And there are certainly times in which frivolous suits are taken and waiting through the course of final adjudication doesn't change whether it's frivolous or not. It just, you might be able to address it more expeditiously.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead.
I think a good case could be made. I think somehow the filing of a suit by one person against the other for passing gas on them has a frivolous nature about it from the very beginning. And I think that point could be made right from the beginning that a filing could be made under the terms of this section.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead, Dan.
My understanding is, I don't want to argue at this point with the Senator, but the judge, without any of this section, the judge has the authority right now to dismiss a case for passing gas on someone. So I'm not certain that we ever entertain the discussion regarding the case involving passing gas on someone.
Well, it is true in any instance, though, that you know, the motion for summary judgment would be the proper way to approach a completely frivolous case at the outset. That is, you know, you could file or you could test it by a demurrer, but you could file a motion for a motion to dismiss. But a motion for summary judgment would be a possible way to test the legitimacy or the merit, or whether the case had merit to start with. I think this section here kind of visualizes both sides getting in there, and the plaintiff's trying to prove its case and the defendant's trying to prove it's a rotten case, which is somewhat the way they do it now. But the issue now is, does the plaintiff have a good case or not, and as a prove the case, and under this thing, the issue would be, has the plaintiff got a case And does the defendant have to pay? Now, let me ask, I'd like to ask the...
I'm over here.
Okay. Paul, going back to what I consider to be the lodestar in our task force deliberations and in the Senate, how would you explain how this procedure would help make insurance available or reduce the cost of it? What's the theory on that?
Well, first of all, I'd like to express my frustration, and just because it was discussed in the task force doesn't mean that we couldn't discuss it and in fact have it in a bill here if we're shooting at the goals of affordability and availability. And one of the biggest problems we've got in the system is an overloaded court system, and litigation takes too long to resolve. And the fact of the matter is, we believe that this will bring about quicker resolution. Bringing about quicker resolution will certainly bring down the cost of the process, and bringing that down will help in the predictability and the affordability issue. So that's what we're looking at.
Anything else on this? Yes, go ahead.
Does anyone have any statistics about how many frivolous cases are brought now, and how much of or is it just that the conditions are such that they're not brought when the quote unquote should be, based on some people's theories of all of this? Is that what we're talking about, or do we have some evidence to indicate that that the frivolous case part of it is taking too long or encumbering
if it prevents, is in the law and prevents just one frivolous action, then it's successful. The fact of the matter, the frustration was expressed yesterday by both Representative Dix and myself, the lack of good information with pertaining to both the court system, settlements, verdicts, and the whole process. Frivolous actions is again an example. You know, what might be frivolous to me may not be to you, mm-hmm. and the judge is going to have to, or someone will have to be the determining factor behind that. But if indeed this results in one less action being taken, and it does expedite the process, and it is permissive, it may be brought, it doesn't say shall be brought, then we can effectively hit the goal of the task force, the Senate, and the House to change the system and provide a better system.
Yes, Dick.
Bill, I'd like to share, I guess, with the conference committee some information that has just come to my attention, prepared by Mr. Reamer within State Bar. He's a counsel, and as I'm sure attorneys are aware, and I think many of the lay members, the bar has a series of ethics and disciplinary rules which govern the conduct of attorneys, and one of those is the ethics rule DR5-101A. I'll make a copy of this for members so we can have it, and also DR5-102, which Mr. Reamer indicates are implicated by the proposal to allow a lawyer to continue handling a lawsuit if a wrongful process claim is filed against a lawyer during a pending lawsuit. Mr. Reamer goes on to opine that a lawyer cannot handle a lawsuit in which he or she will be a witness on behalf of his or her client, though another lawyer in his or her law firm may continue the case. He says this rule would not ordinarily be involved here in DR5-102A and B. He further states a lawyer cannot handle a lawsuit when he or she learns or it is obvious that the lawyer or a member of his or her firm may be called as a witness other than on behalf of the lawyer's client, if it is apparent the lawyer witness's testimony is or may be prejudicial to the lawyer's client. This rule could bar a lawyer and the firm's involvement in a case in which he or she is a defendant pursuant to a counterclaim for wrongful process. That's DR5-102C. He concludes that a lawyer cannot pursue a lawsuit in which his or her personal or financial interests are implicated unless he or she makes full disclosure to his or her client and the client consents. This rule would require full disclosure and consent for the lawyer to continue in any case in which he or she was a defendant with a client. and I'll make copies of that. I think council did some additional research, or did some research on this, and if we may ask Catherine to share what information her research...
Before that, a question to you, Representative Springer. The statutory changes and statutory provisions supersede bar rules?
Well, I'm not sure I can give you an absolute answer on that.
It depends. Could I put in here and try to explain that? It just depends on what it is. That is, certainly the legislature could abolish the requirement that you have to take a bar exam, but the legislature could not get involved in the powers of the Supreme Court to regulate the practice of law. So when it comes to disciplinary rules, the legislature couldn't change those. The legislature could make those more strict, but the legislature couldn't relieve or reduce the discipline. That's my opinion. The legislature could not say to the Supreme Court, we don't want you to have any disciplinary rules, or we want you to change this because it's too hard.